firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects. Michael Wilbur and Tom Shan here together with our faithful technical cast in different parts of the country, and we're very appreciative to the listeners to hang in there with us and catch what we're going to be talking about this month, which includes a brief rundown of a couple of just recent accidents. We've been doing a little bit better here over the last 4 to 6 weeks, thankfully, as we wind down into the end of calendar year 2009. We're going to be talking about just last-minute updates of what's going on in the apparatus industry with the last-minute, a little bit of a spurt in bidding and sales activity with people that want to be able to secure 2007 engines in lieu of what's coming down the pipe. Talk briefly about a few major cities with some awards of large contracts for apparatus. And then we're going to finish up the better part of our podcast this month. We're going to talk about some strategies for reviewing bids as a result of some work that Michael and I have done for folks, and as well as some inquiries that we've gotten in through different sources. And it appears that people are looking for some guidance that once they open up the night of the bid opening, and whoever reads the cover sheets of the 3, 4, 5, or in some cases we've seen upwards of 8 or 10 bids on a project, and it's like, okay, well, now we know where everybody's prices are. What do we do now? And we're going to be talking about that in depth today to maybe give you folks some guidance for those of you that are in the purchasing mode right now, to give you some tips and hints for what you can do to assist you through the process of reviewing those that numerous amount of binders and material that you get after the bid opening. So we'll start out with Brother Mike. What do you have for us today to start out on a little rundown of some recent accidents and things going on at your end there with respect to driving?
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. Welcome. We start out this morning with a crash that just recently occurred in the state of Pennsylvania, and it was an ambulance that got in a head-on crash with an F-150 pickup truck, and all were belted in the ambulance, and they all survived. The pictures on the website, emergencyvehiclerespondse.com, you can take a look at that. That happened on the 19th of November, and the front end of the ambulance was really just hammered, and yet everybody was belted in and survived. Just another indication that seatbelts really, really work. In Mississippi, two firefighters were injured when their apparatus rolled over. It's unknown, their injuries, or it's unknown if they were wearing seatbelts or not. Many of the things each month remain the same stuff. Over and over, an ambulance was struck at a scene in Florida, in Jacksonville, on I-95 ramp. The ambulance was stopped at the scene while medics checked the passengers of the first wreck. When they were doing their risk assessment of the patients, a delivery truck failed to clear the scene and crashed into the back of the ambulance, ramming it into a Jersey barrier and then flipping it on its side. The truck continued farther and then ended up demolishing the rear end of a police cruiser. Five people, including one police officer, were taken to the hospital. In a city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, a firefighter was injured earlier this month when he allegedly hit the door handle on an enclosed apparatus and ended up falling out of the apparatus. Again, it's unclear whether he was wearing seatbelts or not, but one would have to assume that he was not, based on the physical evidence. In Australia, there was a serious apparatus crash. Again, pictures of an apparatus that was flipped over. So, folks, it's not just us. It's not a U.S. problem. It's not a North American problem. It's an everybody problem as we continue to struggle to try and get emergency vehicles in a safe manner from point A to point B. In the state of Florida, again, a tire flies off of a fire truck. It was in Dana Beach. Said the truck was moving east when its lights and sirens were on, and the tire just literally fell off the truck. And Tom, I understand that there may be some changes coming down the pike as it relates to this, or I remember at a conference or something where they were talking about having to change out tires every 7 years. Do you have any thoughts or any information on that?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, Michael, but I believe that was something that was embedded in the NFPA standard on apparatus maintenance, where it was recommending that tires be changed out at that particular interval. Even in departments in the past, the attitude has been, well, we don't run a lot, and there's still adequate tread depth, you know, legal or otherwise, left on the tires. But after a period of time, the tires begin to dry rot and disintegrate, and to the fact where they could no longer be considered serviceable. And I guess a parallel to that would be not necessarily on a time frame, but for fire hose. You know, there's people that you say, well, you know, I visually inspect my tires. We keep them inflated. We only run a couple hundred coils a year. Well, you can say the same thing about your hose, that you could test it annually and maybe even change out the hose load occasionally. You know, there's something that you say in a lot of departments. You can look at the bottom bed portion of the hose bed, and again, parallel back the tires, and say, well, that's been there for quite a while. You can just tell from the dirt accumulation. Say, do you guys ever just like swap the hose out and put what was on bottom on top or whatever? Obviously, on fire apparatus, because we have different sizes of tires from front to rear. It's unlike our POVs, where, you know, every 7,000 or 8,000 miles you're going in and you're having your tires rotated. You know, typically do that, particularly in the same pattern where you're going, you know, front to rear, because of the different various tire sizes that we have on the rig. So that's something, Michael, that people should pay some heed to, in addition to the fact that make sure that the lug nuts are properly torqued, that even if the wheel and tire assembly has not been off the unit, where it should reasonably be off at least a couple times a year for PM to go be checking and doing annual inspections. If it hasn't been off for a while, you still want to make sure that the lug nuts are properly torqued, which in this case, based on that last story you just had, would kind of lead you to believe, kind of like the gentleman possibly falling out of the cab because possibly he didn't have his seatbelt on. I think there's a lot of possibilities in there that would turn out to be more true than false at some point.
Thanks for your insight, Brother Tom. We continue on now, and again, this is just another sign of the times. A Tennessee citizen is suing a city and the fire apparatus driver over a non-emergency driving mishap with the fire apparatus. This is in the city of Franklin, Tennessee. She was injured when her car was struck by the fire truck. Mary Ellen Murphy, 53, is seeking more than $100,000 from the city. And the fire truck driver that struck her on October 17th. Ms. Murphy was driving a 2000 Toyota Avalon, and the firefighter was leaving the Alexandria Plaza Shopping Center. Murphy's car was in a lane for vehicles to turn right or go straight. The fire truck came into the left turn lane, but the firefighter driving turned right and struck the Toyota's left side, according to police reports. The fire truck was not traveling at a high rate of speed, and firefighters were not responding to a call. The fire truck suffered an estimated damage of $400, while Murphy's car suffered what was described in a police report as severe damage. She was taken to the hospital. Her injuries were not described in the police report. Murphy claims that the firefighter was not paying properly attention to traffic around him and failed to maintain control of the fire truck or properly look out. The city has until late this month to respond to that complaint.
Well, Mike, a fire truck versus a Toyota Avalon, $400 damage compared to severe damage. Looks like the fire truck won again there, huh?
Yeah, we generally win, although not really. We win the wreck, but when it comes to all the aftermath, we generally end up big losers. And again, what could consider to be just another sign of the times, a responding fire apparatus was struck in Delaware while a civilian was talking on a cell phone, and she was found to be at fault. The civilian driver drove around cars, yielding for the ladder truck, and struck it. All members were belted in. The civilian driver was reported to be on her cell phone. Two people in the car were reportedly trapped briefly, and when they bounced off the fire truck, and there were no life-threatening injuries in that. And then finally, this morning, November 3rd in Kokomo, Indiana, was a Saturday, crashed and injured four in the apparatus and heavily damaged their apparatus. Kokomo police have exonerated the three firefighters involved in the crash, but did say that none of them were belted in. The civilian driver ran a red light before plowing into the left rear axle of the pumper engine, and she was listed in fair condition. Any other thoughts, Tom, on our rundown of apparatus calamities and accidents this month?
Well, you know, it seems like, Mike, as soon as you think that we're doing better and we maybe lay back a little bit in our confidence level, you know, there haven't been any serious, real serious apparatus accidents recently. The one that caught my attention more than any of them was the incident in Philadelphia, which unfortunately has been repeated in a number of other communities where we have a fleet of four-door cab units with some of the more recent technology with roll stability control, funnel and side airbags. We have probably better safety equipment inside of the cab and with some of the componentry than we've certainly ever had in my 38 years in the fire service. And yet we continue, no matter what the scenario is and who's involved, be it career or volunteer, that you read these stories of people exiting out of the cab, and whether it was a defect in the apparatus with the door, they thought the door was closed or the latch mechanism or whatever. If you've got your seatbelt on and if you're properly seated and belted, it's pretty darn difficult to fall outside of the fire truck. And if we can continue to plead to our brother and sister firefighters to get them to stay seated and belted, I just don't know how many times you have to deliver the message. It's kind of like when you go to church and every other week, if you happen to be in a parish that wasn't doing well financially, and you get the bi-monthly financial appeal, it's like how many times do you have to plead and get the message out there before everybody really takes it seriously. You know, Dr. Burt Clark's done a great job with his seatbelt pledge and just a whole host of other fire service folks for people who walk the walk. We need to be able to get everyone to be seated and belted, and anything less than 100% compliance for those of you that are then in the minority that aren't complying with that, you unfortunately are the ones at risk, as well as obviously your family and your dependents who are counting on you to come home from the run. So, at any rate, having said that, a couple of things, Mike, as we're winding down here, we probably got less than, as we're recording this, probably less than 6 weeks left in the calendar year here for 2009. And there has been, which is fortunate for the folks in the apparatus industry, a little spike and bubble in people getting last-minute, we call it last-minute bids out, in anticipation of beating the end of the year, either a perceived price increase, but more importantly, the technology and the cost avoidance from the 2010 EPA requirements for engine emissions. So a couple of thoughts there. Mike and I have both had contact with people in various states that are in the process, as we speak, of trying to secure a bid from an apparatus manufacturer that they prefer to do business with. And a couple of hints, I guess, for our listeners out there. if you're working with just one or two vendors on your project, you probably want to get both verbally and in writing from them what their current status of engine availability is. Understanding that after 2010, obviously both, as we've talked about extensively in the past, Caterpillar and Detroit are going to be leaving the market. Detroit has a technology partnership with Pierce Oshkosh, so a different version of the Detroit diesel will be available through that manufacturer. But for most of the other builders, we're going to be down, as we've spoken in the past, to either Cummins, or in a couple of cases, there will be some opportunities to do something with a Navistar engine. But no matter who you are talking to, you want to be able to get accurate, up-to-date information. And I was just going to make a parallel, Mike, and say something about it's like the weather forecast. It changes daily, so you need to get daily updates. Well, hopefully your apparatus manufacturer, your salesperson, your factory contact, or whomever, he might be a little bit more accurate than the weatherman is, but you need to keep that information up and be current as to what's going on. If he told you 4 weeks ago, said, oh, not to worry, I got three dozen big block Cummins engines, and I'm down to 20 ISL 425s, you need to touch base with him and find out where he's at right now. You need to get, you know, complete and accurate information, and then be able to plug that into your bidding process. And if your bidding process can be fast-tracked, by that meaning not circumventing any of the normal rules and regulations from a legal standpoint, but if you have the ability to put the unit out on the street for a minimum number of days, whereas in the past, Michael and I have talked and said if you put the bid out, it should be out on the street nominally for at least 30 to 45 days, you may need to look at taking that cycle time and reducing it to make sure that you are going to get the engine of your choice. For those folks out there that are operate in a department where you are fortunate enough because of either local municipal laws or how you get your funding stream, that you do not have to go to a public bid where you're tied into the rules and regulations of municipal bidding laws, you have a little bit more flexibility there where you can refine and define the specs, you know, put it out for a minimum period of time and award the contract. But suffice to say, the engine availability is going to be limited no matter who you are talking to, and don't get put into the position, which I'm sure at some point we will hear stories as we get into the first and second quarter of next year, if people said, you know, oh, you know, the bidder said he was going to have the engine, but when he bid it, he wasn't able to bid the 2007 engine. And we already have seen bids where people of the manufacturers, they obviously have to cover their backsides as well, that they are putting language in there stating that the bid is predicated upon the community making an award and making it in time so that the bidder can actually supply the engine that's being offered. And if those engines go away, then the bidder is free to offer a 2010 engine. But at this point, I haven't seen any out there, at least as of a couple of weeks ago, Mike, where somebody was quoting a, you know, firm figure for what the upcharge for the 2010 engine and installation was going to be. So word to the wise, if you're in that part, move through the process as fast as you can and make sure you keep in constant contact with a reliable source from the manufacturer and or manufacturers that you're working with or that you believe are going to bid on your project, and make sure that you can get one of those engines. There is, I believe, still a small window of opportunity with some manufacturers that you can do an engine pre-buy that we've talked about previously, and that in most cases locks you in then to that manufacturer. But you can pre-buy the engine at a fixed sum, generally in the area of $30,000 to $35,000, and then you own the engine. You can take your time a little bit to decide the configuration, unlike where we were last year at this time, where people were pre-buying because of the cost avoidance or their perceived avoidance of the additional regulations that came down the pipe from the NFPA 1901 changes. Now here we are, you know, less than a year later, and we're in the same position with folks doing things because of the engines, Mike. So, and for that reason, you know, you're looking at a lot of people are sitting back, particularly with respect to the fact that many communities have greatly reduced, if not eliminated, their capital funding stream for any kind of projects. I was in a community a couple of weeks ago, you know, a modest-sized city where all of the capital projects had been put on hold, period. I mean, and so the fire department was a little bit dismayed because for the second year running, they had put in for a pumper and thought they were going to get it. But when they talked to the, you know, the city council, they straight out looked at the fire chief and said, you know, we're very sorry, but not only are you not getting, you know, your fire truck, the police department is not getting any police vehicles. We are not doing any bond issues or referendums to do some other street improvements and curb work and sewer upgrades and stuff. So the bottom line was in that community, because of a large reduction in their income from a combination of sales tax and real estate transfer tax and some of their other sources of income that in the past had funded all of those things, they're just saying in 2010, we're not doing anything, period, including your fire truck. So sad state of affairs, but that's where we are, and that's where our economy is right now here in October of 2009. So on a little bit more positive note, a couple of cities, Michael, including one that you are very familiar with, have recently awarded bids for multiple units over a multiple-year contract. Starting out here on the East Coast, and there's been a fair amount of conversation about this within the apparatus industry, as well as a lot of comments up on the firehouse.com website under the apparatus innovations. But the FDNY has awarded a multiple-year contract to Ferrara Fire Apparatus to supply rear-mount ladders for the city for the next several years. I believe the total initial order is going to be 20 units over the first 3 years. And what makes this kind of notable for our listeners, particularly some of our younger listeners who don't have a deep knowledge of the history of the FDNY apparatus fleet, that the rear mount apparatus has been around in New York since the early 1970s, and other than one initial purchase of a demonstrator unit where the FDNY purchised an America LaFrance demonstrator unit and a Seagrave demonstrator unit when they were starting to look at an alternative to their tractor-drawn ladders, and that's where they were had already been heavily into getting tower ladders or aerial scopes, that it was that time. Since that period, they have bought nothing but Seagrave rear-mount ladders over a period of years. The first Seagrave ladder went in, was acquired by FDNY back in 1969, and through, I want to say, a year ago, because I don't believe that they had any current purchase for rear mounts, you're looking at over a 40-year time span almost of purchasing nothing but Seagrave apparatus, 100-foot units in both single axle and then in later years tandem axle, with very, very few derivations from that. One derivation back in 1982, and they tried to buy two Mac rear mount ladders that had they were 106-foot units that had LTI designed and built aerials, and they were marketed as the Mac Bulldog aerial, and they purchased two of those. But other than that, FDNY has been solidly in Seagrave, so the purchase of the Ferrara is quite newsworthy. Mike, from your perspective, since you operate and have spent a good part of your career, other than I know those several painful months where you probably operated on a Mac pumper, most all of your experience has been on the Seagrave rear mount. So anything you'd like to add there?
Yeah, it was interesting. First, a couple things with the city of New York. If you go back in history, Tom, like you spoke of, we can buy two of anything, it appears, without going out to competitive bid for whatever reason. And so over the years, we have tried several different kinds of ladders or tower ladders, always to revert back to generally what we've always bought, which are Seagrave aerials and aerial scope towers. But again, like you had said, I had that few painful months in an engine company. Well, at that time, when I was there for 18 months in Harlem, they actually, Ladder 3-0, took delivery of one of those Mac 106-foot Bulldogs, and they really tended to like it quite well, and it tested well, but it ended up going by the wayside. In the early 80s, Supton Corporation out of Columbus, Ohio, delivered a couple of towers to New York. They were tried for a few years and then got ferried out. And then there were a couple of LTI rear-mounted aerial towers on American LaFrance low-profile chassis that were tried out. And again, the reports back on those tended to be relatively good as far as trials, but those were thrown by the wayside, and we continue to buy Seagrave, which is not necessarily a bad thing either, but one of the things that I had always had discussions about in apparatus committee meetings when I was on that committee was the fact that our fleet being so large, what would happen, just say, for instance, if a widget on a Seagrave truck failed and all other 142 trucks had the same widget, do you really want to take the other 142 trucks out of service and leave 8.2 million people without fire department aerial service? And the answer to that probably is not, but the idea of having all your eggs in one basket, particularly with a fleet as large as the city of New York's, may not necessarily be the answer. So I kind of welcome the idea that we're going to vary our fleet a little bit. Certainly from a training perspective, it makes it a little more difficult. And certainly from maintenance and a used part perspective, it makes it a little more difficult. But it just always seemed to make sense to me that particularly as volatile as the apparatus industry has become, with people coming and going in and out of business and then reviving themselves under different names, it just seems to me that to have all your eggs in one basket with such a large fleet was pretty unnerving.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, Mike. And then we go out to the West Coast, where we have both the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles, two separate large fire department organizations, at the same time put out bids, and the L.A. City Pumper and the L.A. County Pumper, while there are some similarities, they're quite different in the way that they are set up because of the way they operate with their different jurisdictions. But the city of Los Angeles put out a bid, a multiple-year bid, I believe it was for 23 pumpers. They haven't purchased units in a couple of years, and that bid was awarded to KME, Kovach Mobile Equipment, for that order. And then L.A. County also put out a rather large bid where they were soliciting bids for 15 pumpers, four tractor-drawn aerials, and to be politically correct, a tender, a water tender. And the successful bidder on that was KME as well. The KME units for the Los Angeles County are going to be based upon the Predator, the severe service cabin chassis. Different people have had different terms for it. I like it, severe service. In other words, this thing is built and it not only looks like a fire truck, but when you open up those cab doors and close them, when you look on the inside, it's designed to be an operating fire truck. It doesn't have a lot of frills. It doesn't have a lot of plastic in there. And those units are going to have 425 horsepower engines. The tractor drawings, which are actually Quillers, we'll get to those in a minute, are going to be powered by 500 horsepower units. And they're going to have dual auxiliary braking systems, both an engine brake and a driveline retarder. The engines are going to be built on real nice short wheelbase, which is pretty standard for the L.A. County, L.A. City environs out there. 175-inch wheelbase, a 1,500 GPM pump, a separate PTO booster pump for pump and roll, which, again, is very common because of the wildland conditions out there. Class A foam system, 500-gallon water tank, and a 25-gallon foam cell. The Quillers, or tractor-drawn ladders, are going to be based, again, on the Predator KME chassis with a 100-foot steel aerial, 164-inch wheelbase on the tractor, and also on the tractor will be the 1,500 GPM pump, a 350-gallon water tank. And that unit for TDA's got a pretty favorable overall length of 55 feet 9 inches in length, and there'll be four of those. And to finish up, the one tender be built on a commercial cabin chassis and will be an elliptical style tender with a 2,500 gallon tank and a 500 GPM, just a PTO pump to support some initial firefighting operations or whatever they might be needing. So it's kind of interesting that those cities were fortunate enough, given even the current financial conditions out there, to look at having these bids promulgated and awarded, securing, locking in the price, locking in the engine availability, and a whole bunch of other things. But the effort that it takes once you get your specifications written and developed, that's the part where it's it takes a little bit of time. Just before the break, we're going to just talk about a couple of upcoming conferences and symposiums that might be well worth you investigating. The first one is the Fire Department Safety Officers Association, FDSOA, will have their annual apparatus symposium once again down in Orlando. Not a bad place to be in January if you live where Brother Mike and I live, in New York. Nice to get down there for a few days. That's going to be held on the 17th through the 20th of January. The third full week in January, 17th through the 20th. You can go on the FDSOA website, which is fdsoa.org, and check it out. You can see the preliminary program up there. A lot of great speakers, a lot of very interesting topics. Our own Brother Mike is going to be on the program with a couple of gentlemen from the apparatus industry talking about what type of equipment you need to carry on your aerial device, and then that's going to launch into a discussion of what's the best type of aerial device for your community to consider buying. So Michael will be there with his expertise. I will be on the program doing a couple of things, one on apparatus rebuilding, and then with a real good friend, past work associate, Mr. Bill Wood from SuperVac out in Loveland, Colorado. Bill and I are going to be putting on a program talking specifically about equipment mounting within your cab and within the body of your different, all different types of apparatus, different ideas, different equipment, and all different ways to go about to go do that. So you might want to consider a good place because Orlando, you can even bring the family down there and skate away to a little Mickey Land for a couple of days before or after the seminar. But the 17th through the 20th of January in Orlando, a great place to be and a really good opportunity for firsthand experience from a lot of the industry experts as well as salespeople and folks that do the kind of apparatus spec work and maintenance work on rigs all the time. And then in March, another great place to be, San Diego. Once again, the Firehouse World, starting with a hands-on program on Monday, the 1st of March, and concluding up on that Friday with exhibits on Friday the 5th, so the first week of March out in San Diego. And once again, Brother Mike and I are honored to be asked to go on out there to put on a couple of programs on different things. You can go up on firehouse.com and click on upcoming shows and check out the program there. You can see a lot of just nationally known speakers and authors in all different aspects of fire service that goes well beyond just apparatus. Every conceivable topic you can think of, folks are going to be out there, as well as some great opportunities for hands-on training. And again, just can't say enough about how nice the city of San Diego is to be able to host this again, and again, for Michael and I to be invited to go out to go participate there. So first through the 5th of March in San Diego, if your travel budget can take you out there, you can still grab some pretty nice airfares and get out there for a couple of days and not only take in the exhibits, but have an opportunity to be trained by some of the best professionals and folks in both the hands-on as well as in a conference setting as well. So we're going to take a break for a few minutes, and we're going to come back to talk about what to do once you open the bids and you're sitting there with four binders in front of you and a stack load of paper, and what in God's name am I going to do with this? So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, we'll be right back in just a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects with Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur. As Tom said, we're on the downhill side of 2009, certainly looking forward to a better 2010. And Tom, you're going to talk a little bit in this segment about what do you do with all the binders that are piled in front of you after a successful bidding procedure, and now you have to go through all this information and try to make some sense and some rhyme or reason and award a contract and a bid. How do we do it?
All right. Well, thanks, Mike. Yeah, it's a couple of things. You know, based on what's going on in the apparatus industry right now, quite candidly, even prior to what we talked about you know, and earlier in the podcast today about, you know, momentarily little, you know, blip up in the number of bids, you know, going out. There seems to me to be a, I don't want to say whether you call it a strategy or it's certainly something that I don't remember seeing in my years, you know, going in the apparatus industry going back 4 to 5 years ago. It's something that's kind of reared itself in the last year or two. But a combination of based on either experience of these folks, by these folks meaning the sales personnel that are putting the bid package together in response to your technical spec that you put out on the street, or a combination of, again, experience and having situations arise where people will write a certain feature or benefit or component into the spec, and it may not be there on another product that obviously costs lesser money. Let's just take one component as an example, which is pretty generic, but yet I think it'll bring the message home. One of the things that Mike and I have talked about extensively in all of our writing and a lot of our discussions with apparatus design relative to the front and the front bumper is to have some type of bumper reinforcement behind. If you're hung up on having that 8-inch or 10-inch or 12-inch high ribbed stainless steel bumper on the front, you want to have some piece of 3/8 or 1/2-inch steel behind that, wrapped around and supported back to the chassis frame rails to protect the front of the apparatus in the hopefully unlikely event that you get involved in an apparatus accident. That particular item, while it's standard from some builders, in more cases than not, it's an option with others, and that option can run anywhere from, I've seen it as low as $800 for a reinforced front bumper, I've seen it as high as $1,500. Suffice to say, whatever it is, it's an amount of money that's there. You can be evaluating the bid and find out, gee, somebody didn't offer that. Now, they didn't take exception to it, and on the exception page, they didn't say, by the way, you're not getting that, all right? More likely than not, it got missed by the person putting the spec together, either consciously or not. In any event, now, that particular product now is either $800 or $1,000 or $1,500 less because that particular item is not included in what you asked for. And that's just one item. Now you can compound that by 8, 10, pick a number, of items that got missed, either, again, inadvertently or by grand design, and you now have somebody that shows up, and you can have four bidders. Let's stay with that number because that works pretty handily. Four bidders, Mike, and have the low bidder, the spread from the low bid to the high bid, in a lot of cases now, is upwards of $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. Certainly, pick a number north of 50 grand. 5 or 6 years ago, if everybody was bidding to the spec, as they say, in other words, nobody was taking literary license with the spec. They would bid to the spec of what was asked for. Wouldn't be uncommon to find those same four bidders be within an $8,000 to $10,000 range of one another, high to low. Now those same four bidders, for whatever reason, right, now there can be $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, pick a number, $80,000 difference, high to low. Now, does that mean that the high-price guy is gouging you and making a ton of money on your community, and the low-price guy is really giving you the best value? That can be the case. It could also be the case that maybe the guy with the lowest price isn't bidding everything that you asked for in your spec. And as communities, as budgets have gotten tighter, folks have realized that in a lot of cases, the technical part of the spec is just like almost a gross overgeneralization of what you're looking for. So the people put a bid together based on a price of where they want to be or how much money they think you want to spend rather than meeting the intent of the spec. Now, that puts the onus back on us, the fire department, the board of fire commissioners, the apparatus committee, whoever, to go through and break down that spec and analyze and find out just what am I getting for my money. And it is not as easy as going into a car showroom and saying, geez, I like the looks of that new Ford Fusion Hybrid. And you can walk right up to the side window, and there's the sticker price. Now, you know you're going to negotiate off of that. But there's the price, and there's everything you get for that price. It's not that simple, right? You've got bid specs that can be anywhere from 60 to over 100 pages in length just for a standard Class A pumper. With every technical thing all spelled out, you've got bidder's compliance column, and you hope the guy's honest because he checked yes on all of this stuff, but do you know, are you really getting it? I've seen a lot of bids, Mike, where the people check yes, but then when you go read their proposal, it's not there. So what do you believe? He checked your spec and said you're getting it, but when you go to his spec, he missed the front bumper extension. He missed the fact that you were supposed to have the AED and some of the loose equipment that you had at the back of your spec, that was, and the radio and the portable chargers for your hand lights and about $8,000 worth of loose equipment, that was all supposed to be included with his bid, but he checked yes in your spec, but it's not listed in his spec. So where do you go? What do you believe? So here's a couple of things, all right? First thing, check for compliance with some of the basic legal things that you ask for or requirements to bidders. For example, make sure that they have included a bid bond. Make sure that they have offered the cost, if you required it, hopefully you did, a performance bond. Make sure the cost of the performance bond is included with his bid and not broken out somewhere as an option. Most importantly, if Mike and I were to assist your department in evaluating the bids, which we do very frequently, get the piece of paper or pages of paper that have the bidder's clarifications and exceptions. That's what they're telling you up front initially that you're not getting. So, for example, you may have pulled out a Michelin tire by size and tread type and tire rating and mile per hour rating. Well, maybe in that vendor's proposal, his vehicle is going to weigh more, so that particular size of Michelin tire can't work. So he should take clarification and tell you what you are getting there rather than you just reading into his spec and finding out, oh, geez, I'm getting a bigger tire here or a different tire. Why am I getting that? That should specifically be called out. Make sure you require, all right, and then evaluate the blueprints. You should then take the blueprint and lay it down next to the bid book and you can start doing your spreadsheet analysis of what you're getting on the vehicle, because the blueprint should literally be a visual depiction dimensionally of what the bidder has included in his 60 to 100 pages of written spec. Look out and make sure that you have included and evaluate the turning radius report, the amp load analysis, and a weight analysis of the vehicle. All right. Take a look at the completeness of the vendor specs. This was an old trick that people did years ago. I haven't seen it done recently, but it forced a lot of vendors to put into their spec, in no case shall the bidder Xerox or duplicate this spec and put it back in as his spec. In other words, if you're bidding a pumper and one unit is a pumper and the other one is a rescue engine, and maybe the cabs are identical, the frames are a little different, the pump boxes might be identical, but the bodies are completely different, then that vendor should be putting in two complete specs, not lumping it all into one spec and have you trying to figure out what's what. Most importantly, look at if you had requirements in there for delivery and training in terms of the required days of delivery and what you expected the vendor to do, the sales organization, and or the manufacturer, particularly if it's an aerial device, to give you unit familiarization, training and familiarization, make sure that that stuff's included. Most importantly, and it's normally always buried in the back, pull out and make copies of their warranty statements. Included in everybody's spec, they'll have a several line thing, for example, saying unit shall have a 7-year paint warranty. Guy checks, yes, you get a 7-year paint warranty. Well, what does that warranty cover? You need to go into their warranty statement and read that specifically line for line. What you will find out that in a lot of cases, whatever the specified warranty period is, particularly with respect to paint, there are either some exclusions in there, which may or may not be to your liking or to the benefit of the fire department, and there also will very likely be some prorating period. So you find out the 7-year paint warranty, it's really maybe a 3-year or a 4-year paint warranty 100%, and then after that point, the warranty is prorated on a percentage of whatever the indicated repairs are. So you want to read that, because you can say a warranty is not a warranty until you read the warranty statement. And if you don't understand it, then you start sending out emails, you know, to those particular vendors and get it in writing as to what that exclusion actually means. And understand it before you go sign the contract. When you sign a contract, then it's too little, too late. So, Mike, any thoughts on those?
Tom, didn't we just go through a set of specs, a couple sets of specs, and there was an issue with the paint warranty? The customer asked for one thing, and the vendor was providing something totally different and didn't even check the exception box?
Yeah, see, that's what we get into. You're absolutely correct, Mike, is that people can say, all right, here's the warranty time frame, all right? And they say, okay, yeah, we have an X-year warranty, and they check yes. And then when you read the statement of warranty, it's obviously, it's written by the manufacturer. In most cases, it's written and approved by a manufacturer's lawyer. So guess what? All of the verbiage is clearly in the favor of the manufacturer. I haven't read too many warranties, Michael, lately, where the warranty was 100% in the favor of the fire department or the purchaser. It's generally the wording of that is generally always to favor the manufacturer. So you want to read those and then compare those back to the clarifications and exceptions. If we go back to what we were talking about initially, whether it be a front bumper extension or some other component that you put in there by name and brand, and it could be something as simple as, you know, Mike, I'm going to toss you a softball here. Could be the ground ladder packaging, all right? I've seen people in an aerial device specifically call for a make and model of Alkalite ground ladder, and then the bidder supplies Duo Safety. Well, we're not saying that Duo Safety is better or worse than Alkalite, but they're two different brands with two different dimensions. So if you bid one brand of ground ladders and the manufacturer checks yes, he's checking yes that you're getting the ladders. You know, the question would be, he's checked yes. Am I getting the ladders, A? B, am I getting the ladders in the proper lengths and quantities that I wanted? And am I getting the correct make and model? Well, then if you go over to his spec and find out, well, you asked for Alkalite, and he's giving you Duo Safety. Well, he should have clarified that. You need to find out, well, why is he not supplying me the brand and make and model that I wanted, or even if it was in the reverse? And by the time, at least in my mindset, Mike, and for the listeners, when I get to about the third or fourth one of those, no matter what component it happens to be that we're talking about, I'm beginning to get a little suspicious. If that wasn't noted in a listing of clarifications and exceptions, I'm beginning to now really seriously wonder, what else am I missing here? All right, what else am I not getting? If he simply went down through 90 pages of yes, no, and just kept checking, you know, first five or six pages, he took a few clarifications. But about the time he gets to page 20 or 25, it's like, frankly, the heck with this. He checks yes to everything, and then the onus is now on us, the bidder, the buyers, to figure this stuff out. So that's the old adage, two words, buyer beware, all right?
If well, you like start you finding... you had said that the warranty, the whole process is kind of, particularly with the warranty, jilted in favor of the manufacturer. One of the things that I learned that you can do to kind of offset that a little bit is that if the apparatus is going to be out of service for repair for an extended period of time during the warranty period, and generally most apparatus manufacturers provide a year's warranty, that if you put verbiage in your bid package and then ultimately sign contracts on that verbiage, that if the apparatus is going to be out of service for, say, a period of time greater than a week or 10 days, that any warranty time that was left on the contract in the course of doing the warranty work would be added onto the back end of the warranty. Otherwise, the manufacturer makes out on both ends, A, for having a truck out of service for that period of time doing the repairs, and B, not having to provide, that's like lost warranty time. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, exactly, Mike. There, if, you know, no manufacturer, I mean, I have seen in large, you know, the heavy-hitting, you know, major municipal departments in the country write warranty language that, you know, most people would not, you know, any, as Bill O'Reilly would say, any clear-thinking American would not sign up to that warranty language, because when the fire department writes it, guess what? It's all on the other side. It's all in the favor of the fire department. So there needs to be the proverbial happy medium. But what you just suggested is perfectly reasonable and rational. That to put a warranty statement in there that if the unit is to be out of service for an extended period of time, name that time, that you know, where the unit is not in use within the fire department for whatever reason, that warranty time will be added on to the back of the 1 year, the 2 year, the 3 year warranty. That makes an awful lot of sense. But you have to put that in your specs up front. You're not going to negotiate that after the fact. All right, particularly when you're in the position of trying to negotiate other strategies for the bid. So the next thing you want to do is, again, with the review and the drawings, take a look at the principal dimensions, the overall length, the wheelbase, overall height. If it's a ladder truck, overall height, very critical, right, to make sure that it meets the criteria that you had in your bid spec. And other principal dimensions, since like the height of the cross lays, the hose bed, interior cab layout, and particularly if it has something that has a major pump on it, ask for a pump panel layout drawing. That may not be included with the bid package that might come at the time of the engineering conference, but at least you can call that out and say, this is our expectation of what we're looking for. You could take the six, no matter where you are for our listeners in the country, you could take the six top first fire truck builders that come to your mind, and that either you like, that are the principal suppliers of stuff in your area, And you could take those six companies and lay those blueprints down next to one another, and you will find all kinds of differences in terms of what that manufacturer considers to be an acceptable proposal or engineering drawing. So if you expect there to be a number of dimensions on there, and or particularly if it's a rescue truck or a complex rescue engine, and you want to see compartment layout drawings and stuff like that, you need to put those requirements in at the time of the bid and have that information available to be able to look at. Once you get that done, then you can move on to whether you want to do it by hand, do it in case for those of the listeners where you have access or somewhat proficient in Microsoft Excel, does a very great job to set up the cells and do a spreadsheet on all of the different major components of the unit, whether it's chassis, unit items, driveline, pump, compartment sizes, cubic foot storage, enclosed areas within the vehicle, and you can list out the components in one column and then across on the top the different manufacturers, and it makes it a lot easier for you then to analyze and change things and update things as you go through. To say that this process is time-consuming is an understatement. You know, there's no hard or fast rule here, but even I think for an experienced person to go through just one spec, if you put out your spec for vendor A, vendor A comes back and says, I got no exceptions. Well, you still need to review his bid. But let's say you get a bid then from vendor B, and that's not somebody that you're necessarily familiar with. For whatever reason, wasn't anybody that you had spoken to. You might know the local salesperson, but you're like, geez, thanks for bidding this, and now I got to look at it. You know, you better plan. It's going to take a good four, five, 6 hours plus to do a thorough review of what they are asking you to do. You just don't read it like a book and say, okay, I got that all committed to memory. Now I'm going to be able to impart all that knowledge back to the committee, all right, or back to the people. If you need to justify, you know, if you're coming in front of a city council that is not necessarily fire truck nor technical savvy, they might be, but chances are they're not, and you're put in a position that you got those four bids we talked about earlier, and there's a $60,000 spread, and you want to award the bid to vendor number three that happens to be $48,000 more money than the guy that was the low bidder, frankly, folks have to have your act together, and you have to have it documented as to where the differences are. So if you're questioned, you can respond and be able to justify your position. And that plays to the point that we talked about. More often than not, folks will not go through this process to evaluate the bids. They will get the bids, the bid numbers back, and if they are held to any degree of accountability with respect to money, what happens more often than not is one or two of the lower bidders, somebody on the council or the finance office or whoever says, if you want a fire truck, you're buying that because that's a fire truck for that amount of money. We're not spending a dime more than whatever X is. So if you haven't done the review and the analysis and don't have your, you know, game plan together, when you go to present this, you just can't say, I want to buy the third highest bidder that's 48 grand more. Why? Well, it's a better truck. You have to come up with a more detailed description than it's a better truck. So if you've gone through and evaluated the material you got, did the spreadsheet, did a detailed review of the exceptions and clarifications, and find out what their impact is on either the performance of the vehicle or the cost. You may find, for example, that you specified this. Let's take this example. On an engine, Mike, this comes to mind. You specified a certain brand of pump governor because that's what you have on your last three units. Well, now because of a minor change in the engine configuration or whatever, that governor by make and model, that's not available anymore. Here's the one that the vendor bid, which may be an improvement over what you've got, and he legitimately cannot supply what you have on the other units in your fleet, even though it's for conformity, because it's not made anymore and it's not compatible with the engine ECU. Well, that's a clarification, but that's to your benefit, and that's something you would want to accept. If somebody took an exception to something that you asked for, maybe let's go into the warning light area. You've got whatever brand standardized of warning lights on 80% of your fleet. That's what you put in your spec. This guy came in, this vendor came in, and he didn't take any exception or clarification. He gave you the right number of lights, LED lights or strobe lights or whatever, but it's not the brand you asked for. It's a completely different brand. Well, that might be pretty significant, and there may or may not be cost impact back on that, but that's something, that's an item of consideration, right? So you take that, you read the warranty statements, and again, if you don't understand the warranty statements and what it excludes in the warranty, then you get in writing a response back to your query as to what that means, or in some cases, I've actually seen in fire departments, right, they've had to give the warranties to their attorney, say, you tell me legally what this means. Let's suppose the whole thing goes south and you've got a 10-year corrosion warranty. Here's a good one, Mike, right? People put, I give you a 10-year cab structural and corrosion warranty. You're feeling pretty happy about that because your first thought is, structural. I guess that means if I get a crack, it gets fixed. Or corrosion. I guess if in year five I see some corrosion around the door handles on my body, that's corrosion. I go back to the manufacturer and I get that fixed, right? Well, you read the warranty and it has a few statements in there saying that the structural warranty covers significant structural components and excludes accessories, hinges, latches, so forth, all right? And any defect is at the discretion of the manufacturer. So now that crack in the body, the guy that comes looks at it and goes, that's small. That's a 3/4-inch crack. Not to worry. I've seen a lot worse than that. And the warranty guy picks up and leaves. Well, where does that leave you? You still got a crack in the body. You think it's structural. That guy's saying not to worry. Where's your warranty? Maybe it didn't come into play here. And to go to the corrosion issue. Most corrosion warranties, when you read the fine print, it is corrosion against rust through. That means you put your small pinky through the hole, and if it's in the fender well area, you can stick your head up in the underneath the tire and say, oh, yeah, there's my pinky. Yep, that's mine. That's rust through. So a lot of these corrosion warranties, it kind of makes you feel warm and fuzzy what you got, but when you read the actual warranty, what it covers, and the exclusion, you might not be getting what you want. Last couple of things to wrap up, all right? So now you've done all of that, and you're thinking, oh, my God, Tom, you know, you told me 4, 5, 6 hours. I think I've got like a day or day and a half in this. You very well may be, but I go back to a couple of things, Mike. One is I continue to like the adage of Sims Clothing, an educated consumer is our best customer. If you haven't educated yourself ahead of time, if you've worked with these couple of different vendors, you can find out what their warranty stuff is before you go to bid. But if you haven't done any of this, this is all assuming you've waited until this point in time to get educated on all of this stuff. Well, now you've got a mountain of work ahead of you. You know, you need to analyze and look at the local dealership and service capabilities. If you're not familiar with the guy, if you haven't visited his shop, if you haven't seen what his facilities and evaluated his capabilities and looked at the different EVT certifications of his personnel, and this guy comes in from left field and drops a bid on you, well, now you got some other work that you're going to have to go out in your bicycle or your car, pedal out there, and find out how this guy's going to take care of you. Because it's the service after the sale that makes it. I have rarely seen a fire department that has dealt with a salesperson in the upfront specification process, possible tour of the factory, bringing demo rigs in, taking you around, helping you through the whole spec process. But once the contract is signed, the unit gets built and delivered, and it goes out of the warranty period, right, that salesperson still could be a friendly, helpful resource, but it's the mechanic that's going to fix your problem. Typically not the salesperson, typically not the person who owns the dealership. They might be great guys and have helped you in past situations, but if the mechanic, you know, if they got a great sales organization, but they don't have any service capabilities, you're kind of out there playing ball, you know, without the proper equipment. So you need to go evaluate that. And then
we have a story, right, Tom, about that?
with a chief that we did business up in Massachusetts, where he finally became fire chief and was able to finally buy his first truck. Had always been a Seagrave fan, always wanted to get a Seagrave, and really didn't particularly care for Emergency One. And now he just took delivery of his second Emergency One Typhoon Pumper. And two things really spirited both those purchases. One was the fact that in New England, at the time that the first pumper was built or that was going out to bid, that there was very little in the way of Seagrave presence in New England as far as service. And he all fire trucks ultimately break at some point in time, as we all know, and who's going to fix it? And that became a grave concern, so that although he liked one particular brand over the other, the fact that that brand couldn't necessarily provide the mechanical support that he felt he needed, he went with the vendor that he was less in love with, and ultimately went on to buy even a second one of them, because the E1 dealership in New England is one of the strongest dealerships in all of fire truck sales. And so it made the choice for him pretty plain and simple. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Mike, it depends. You can have business or friendship relationships with folks, but when it comes time to buying a piece of fire apparatus, I guess the only practical thing you could relate to is you know, buying a car. Right? If assuming that you buy it, you're not leasing something, you're going to own it for a number of years. You need to give some due consideration to where am I going to take this thing when it needs to get repaired. In the case and situation that Mike just referred to, at the time when this one chief was interested in buying a rig, Seagrave did not have a dealership in that state. It came from an adjacent state, so obviously they had very little presence in the area. That has since changed. So after that 12-month warranty wears out, if you think about that, you want to keep a fire truck, be it for 15 or 20 years. 20 to some people now seems like a long, long time. But whatever the time period is, after the first year of ownership and the warranty goes out, the next 14 or 19 years are on your dime, generally, all right, unless it's a major component that goes out. And if your community has a very strong maintenance program, if you have in-house mechanics or mechanics that you contract with that are going to go do your work and work on that particular make and model, that's great. If not, there's a lot of folks that kind of get more enthralled with the bells and whistles and what they see and what the vendor's offering them up front, and give little consideration to saying, okay, if this thing breaks, and we'll kind of wrap up today's commentary with this, but here's this is a pretty good one, all right? There was, for a number of years, several manufacturers that had their own private label water tank level gauge, right? Now, for those listeners out on the West Coast, you're probably already sitting back and belly laughing, because you're thinking to yourself, yeah, we've got a pretty reliable water level gauge out here. It's called a sight tube, and it works real well, and there's nothing mechanical. And since we live in a climate where it doesn't freeze, it's 100% reliable, and there's no sensor in the tank or anything. Well, for the rest of America, we have been buying, Mike, I think about it, right? I've been in the fire service now for a little over 38 years, and we still are, in some cases, although it's improved dramatically, struggling trying to find a reliable water tank level gauge. Not to beat up any particular manufacturer, there's a couple of brands out there that are just, they're home runs. They're so much improved over what we had even 3 or 4 years ago. It's amazing. But be that as it may, for a period of time, there were a couple of manufacturers that built their own private labeled water tank level gauge. It wasn't made by any one of the the name vendors out there. So guess what? After the one-year warranty, when your tank, water tank level gauge goes out, where do you have to go for parts? You're going back to the guy that you bought the whole fire truck from. If you buy a car and you get bad windshield wipers and have to replace them, or any one of the other replaceables, windshield wipers, tires, you know, things like that, consumables, you generally don't go back to the car dealership, unless you've got one of those really high-end imports, to go buy replacement windshield wipers or tires. You buy them at another local vendor where you take your business. Well, when you have to start going back to the guy who built your whole fire truck for things like that or other electrical components, now you're really married at the hip with those folks. And that might not necessarily be bad if you've got a very good relationship with that local vendor, if they're reasonably close, if you've got a good track record with parts, if you're a big enough department, maybe you might even stock some of those parts on the shelf. But if you're running around in a little small, you know, two-station volunteer fire department in the middle of our great country, and you have a water tank level gauge that goes out on your combination engine tanker, now you've got a problem, and if your closest fire truck repair facility is 4 hours away, you are unlikely to drive old engine 2 over the road 4 hours each way to get your tank level gauge fixed. Wouldn't it be nice to have parts that are commercially available or that you can get back from the people who built it? So to wrap up here, Michael, it's an extensive process, but what we see more often than not is at the time of the couple days after the bid opening, people are simply overwhelmed with the process as to how to properly go through and look at the bids, how to evaluate them without preconceived prejudices coming in with it. There's six guys on a truck committee and there's five vendors. Chances are that maybe one guy's the black sheep there, but somebody on a committee's already got a favorite of whose rig they want to buy, price put aside, without even paying any attention to what you're really getting. And since you're going to have the fire truck for 15 or 20 years, and it's going to be on your dime for 14 or 19 of those years after the warranty goes out, it sure would be nice to do your homework at that point. If you haven't done it prior to then, well, now it's showtime. Now they've just had the seventh inning stretch, and you got two innings to figure this out, to get through and analyze everything, so you can wrap it up and make a qualified recommendation to your counsel or whomever is going to approve the process. So if readers of the magazine, listeners for our podcast, if you have any questions, comments on anything we've talked about, please feel free to send them in to the website at podcast@firehouse.com. Or you can contact Mike and I through our website at emergencyvehiclerespondse.com, and we'll be happy to help you. We hope that today's podcast has been helpful. And, Michael, any final parting thoughts?
Just a couple, Brother Tom. One, like you alluded to in kind of a different verbiage, but knowledge is power. The more that you know about the process, the more help you can get, the more knowledgeable people that you have in the process, and that may include the salesman, but should not be necessarily the whole kettle of knowledge that you're banking on, the process is going to just absolutely go a lot better, because knowledge truly is power. The second thing is, and we keep finding this over and over and over again, is that the more work that the apparatus committee does in the beginning, it's less expensive, and the project tends to come out much better at the end of the day. If you read through the specs, and a lot of people, believe it or not today, still don't, but if you read through the specs and really understand what you're buying and lay the truck out and know what equipment's going in what compartment, and go to the pre-build conference, the pre-construction conference, and have it all laid out, when it comes time for that mid-inspection or the final inspection, we're not spending tens of thousands of dollars in change orders for stuff that was really apparent had you done the work up front. By the time that a good apparatus committee gets to the final inspection, with the exception of a few punch list items, it should be really kind of a culmination and a joyous trip rather than an arduous work undertaking, because you've done so much of the work up front, where it costs far less to do. You know, my dad, God rest his soul, probably gave me the best advice that any father could give a son. And he always told me that there were two ways to do things. You could do them right or again. And in the fire apparatus industry, if you have to do it again or change things up, it becomes more expensive, and it's just cheaper and easier to do it up front in the beginning than to wait till the end of the process.
Mike, great words to wrap up on. So for our listeners, thanks very much. As we're taping this, we're a couple of days away from Thanksgiving, and wishing all our listeners a very happy and safe Thanksgiving holiday, and we'll look for you out on the road and the next time when we have an opportunity to meet. Until then, it's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. Be safe out there and take care.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.